Imagine you have 10 people sitting in a room together.
Okay.
And you walk down the line and give every single one of them the exact same dose of an identical, highly potent molecule. Like, let's say it's psilocybin.
Right, a classic psychedelic.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if we apply standard medical logic to the scenario, you'd expect 10, you know, roughly similar physiological and psychological outcomes.
Because that's how most drugs work.
Right. I mean, you give someone a beta blocker, their heart rate drops, it's predictable. Yeah. You give someone psilocybin, you should get a predictable result. But you don't. You get 10 completely different universes.
This is wild.
It is. Some of those people will experience this profound sense of bliss, a feeling of universal connection, maybe even a tearful homecoming.
Yeah.
But others sitting right next to them taking the exact same pill will experience absolute bone-chilling terror.
Which is the big mystery, right? The molecule is exactly the same.
The dose is exactly the same. Everything physical is the same. So what changes? Well, the answer is hidden in what researchers call the non-drug half of psychedelic medicine.
The invisible half, basically.
Yes, exactly. So today, for all of you listening, we're doing a deep dive into this fascinating article from the OOTW Journal. We want to figure out why, when it comes to these specific compounds, your environment isn't just some backdrop. It is literally an active ingredient.
And, you know, it completely rewrites how we think about pharmacology.
Yeah.
Understanding this phenomenon is so crucial because it isn't just some quirky anomaly that only applies to psychedelics.
Right.
Unraveling why those 10 people have 10 different experiences actually gets to the very core of how the human brain constructs reality and meaning. We are really looking at a fundamental mechanism of human consciousness.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to solve this mystery of the 10 different universes, we kind of need to go back in time a bit.
We do, yeah. Back to the vocabulary.
Right. We need to look at the vocabulary researchers use to even, you know, talk about this wild variability. The OOTW Journal article takes us back to 1961 to a Harvard psychologist whose name you probably recognize, Timothy Leary.
Oh, yeah, a very famous name.
Right, but this is before things got intensely controversial. Before the counterculture movement and way before psychedelics were placed on Schedule 1, Leary was just running these early trials. And he coined a two-word framework that the field honestly still uses to organize itself today. He called it set and setting.
And it's really crucial to understand that Leary wasn't just like pulling these terms out of thin air.
They didn't just make them up.
No, not at all. Nor was he inventing some sort of mystical folk wisdom. As the historian Ido Hartogson points out in our source material, this framework was the distilled, hard-won observation of the very first researchers in the field.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, think about what those early clinical trials looked like in the 1950s and early 60s. You had psychiatrists giving these powerful compounds to patients in these sterile, cold, fluorescent-lit hospital wards.
Sounds awful, honestly.
It was, and often with absolutely no preparation. The results were just chaotic. Sometimes patients had breakthroughs, but very often they were absolutely terrified.
Makes sense.
But then researchers would see someone take the exact same compound in a comfortable room, maybe with some music playing, surrounded by supportive friends.
Then it was different.
Completely different. The outcome was beautifully therapeutic. So the variability wasn't a flaw in their experimental design. The variability was the discovery itself.
Okay, so let's define those two words clearly for you listening, just so we're all on the same page. Set refers to the mindset you bring into the experience, like your internal landscape.
Right, what's going on inside your head.
Exactly. And setting refers to the physical and social world you take the compound in, the external landscape.
The room, the people, the vibe.
Yeah. And when you stop and think about it, that is so utterly counterintuitive to how we are traditionally taught to think about medication. I mean, if I take an aspirin for a headache, it works the exact same way, whether I'm screaming at a loud rock concert or sleeping quietly in my bed.
Exactly.
The aspirin model is fixed. Swallow the molecule, get the effect. The drug really doesn't care about my feelings.
Right. But the aspirin model falls apart entirely here. Psychedelics do not bypass your context. They're entirely dependent on it. And, you know, modern neuroscience finally gives us the biological mechanics of why this happens.
Oh, this is the brain receptor stuff, right?
Classic psychedelics like psilocybin or LSD work primarily by overstimulating a very specific receptor in the human brain. It's called the serotonin 2A receptor, or 5-HT2A.
5-HT2A, got it.
Now, these receptors aren't just scattered randomly throughout your nervous system. They are woven incredibly densely throughout the brain's high-level association cortex.
Wait, I want to pause on that term, association cortex, because it sounds like, you know, heavy medical jargon. Let's explain what that actually does. If I'm understanding the brain's geography correctly, the association cortex is essentially the brain's CEO, right? It's like the meaning weaver.
That is an excellent way to describe it, actually. See, your brain takes in raw, unfiltered sensory data all the time. Shapes of light, sound waves, changes in temperature.
There's constant data streams.
Exactly. But raw data doesn't mean anything on its own. The association cortex is the region that takes that raw data, cross-references it with your memories, your beliefs, your expectations, and then tells you what it all means.
Oh, okay. So it interprets the world for you.
Right. It's the part of the brain that looks at a long, squiggly shape on a hiking trail and instantly decides, that's a venomous snake. Feel fear. Or that's just a stick. Keep walking.
Wow. So it's doing a lot of heavy lifting.
A massive amount. It models meaning, manages expectation, and essentially constructs your ongoing sense of self.
Okay, so when a psychedelic molecule hits those densely packed 5-HT2A receptors, it isn't just like injecting a prepackaged hallucination into your brain.
Not at all.
It's not a movie file you just press play on. It's actually turning up the dial on your brain's own meaning-making machinery.
Yes. It throws that machinery into absolute overdrive. The association cortex stops filtering and starts connecting everything. And if the drug amplifies the machinery, we really have to ask what that machinery is actually running on.
Which is context, right?
Exactly. Runs on context.
Really?
So if you chemically crank up the brain's sensitivity to context, then context naturally takes the wheel. The drug just makes your nervous system extraordinarily porous, like incredibly vulnerable to whatever's happening internally and externally.
Which perfectly explains why those 10 people from our intro had 10 completely different trips.
Yep. The mystery solved.
The drug just turned up the volume on 10 different internal contexts. So let's crack open the first half of that 1961 framework, the set.
The internal landscape?
Right. What is actually inside this internal environment? Because the researchers in the OOTW journal article, they break down into a few distinct measurable layers. First, they talk about enduring personality traits, specifically something called trait openness.
Yeah, and to put that in everyday terms, trait openness is just a psychological measure of how willing you are to embrace the unfamiliar.
Like how adventurous you are.
Basically. Are you someone who is fairly rigid, who loves strict routine and prefers the known? Or are you highly flexible, someone who really thrives on new ideas and ambiguity?
Right.
A person with high trait openness is naturally going to have a very different internal baseline when the walls of their reality start to melt compared to someone who deeply, deeply needs control.
Yeah, that makes total sense. If you need control, losing it is going to be terrifying.
That's exactly.
So you have your baseline personality traits. Then the article says set includes your acute state, meaning are you exhausted today? Are you grieving? Are you feeling joyful?
The immediate emotional weather, basically.
Yeah. Right. It also includes your intentions. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you choosing to take this compound? Are you trying to heal from deep trauma, or are you just, you know, bored on a Saturday at a festival?
Which is a huge distinction.
Oh, for sure. But the absolute biggest factor they highlight, the quiet giant in the room, is expectation. Like, cool. What you believe is going to happen actively biologically shapes what actually happens.
What's fascinating here is how modern researchers are categorizing this.
Huh?
There's a 2023 paper cited in our source material by Pernillas Morgan, Hardigson, and Remakers.
Right, the super placebo paper.
Yeah. They argue that in psychedelic science, expectation isn't just some annoying, confounding variable that ruins clinical trials.
Which is how scientists usually view it, right?
Exactly. But here, they say it is a core mechanism of therapeutic change in its own right. Because of this dynamic, they refer to psychedelics as active super placebos.
Wow.
The hope you carry into the session becomes a literal, biological, self-fulfilling prophecy. And crucially, so does the dread.
Wait, I really need to push back on this terminology for a second. Because calling a psychedelic a super placebo feels like a dangerous misnomer.
How so?
Well, when I hear the word placebo, my mind goes straight to a sugar pill.
Sure, the classic definition.
Yeah, a fake drug in a clinical trial that physically does nothing, but my brain tricks me into feeling better just because a doctor in a white coat handed it to me. Are these researchers actually suggesting that profoundly powerful, reality-altering chemicals are just, I don't know, biological parlor tricks?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because that phrasing definitely trips up a lot of people. When they say active super placebo, they are absolutely not saying the drug is fake or biologically inert.
Okay, good.
The pharmacology is incredibly real. The molecules binding to those 5-HT2A receptors we talked about, causing massive cascades of neurological activity and completely altering blood flow in the brain.
So it's a very real physical event.
Very real.
Yeah.
But this is the key distinction. The primary function of that massive pharmacological activity is to make the brain uniquely, wildly responsive to expectancy.
Oh, I see. So the chemical effect of the drug is just to create a state of extreme plasticity.
Yes. Think of the brain under psychedelics, like a piece of glass being heated up in a furnace.
Okay, glass in a furnace.
The heat is the drug. And the heat is very real, right? It fundamentally changes the physical properties of the glass, making it soft and malleable.
Right, it gets all glowing and bendy.
Exactly. But the heat doesn't decide what shape the glass will ultimately take. The glass blower decides that.
Yeah.
In this analogy, your expectation, your mindset, your set the tag, that's the glass blower.
Oh, wow. That is a brilliant way to visualize it. So a standard placebo relies on your normal, cold, rigid baseline level of expectation to generate, you know, a slight healing effect.
Right.
But a classic psychedelic heats up the glass, taking that expectation and multiplying its power exponentially. If your internal signal is fear and resistance, the drug makes that fear overwhelming.
It becomes a nightmare.
But if your internal signal is a deep desire to heal, the drug makes that therapeutic breakthrough highly probable.
Exactly. The drug is the amplifier. Your expectation is the audio signal being amplified. It doesn't replace the placebo effect. It weaponizes it for healing.
Okay, so if the internal world is the glass being heated up to this state of extreme malleability, we also have to look outside the brain.
The setting.
Right. What happens when a cold breeze blows into the room while the glass is hot? This brings us to the second half of Leary's framework, the setting or the external environment. And the source material highlights some incredible prospective studies out of Imperial College London.
Yes, led by researchers like Hygin and Carhart-Harris around 2018.
Right, and they wanted to see if they could mathematically prove this concept, didn't they?
And they did. They actually took a large group of people who were already planning to use psychedelics, and they measured their baseline psychological state beforehand.
So they got the set baseline.
Exactly. Then they meticulously documented the exact physical environments where the trips took place. Every detail. Finally, they evaluated the participants afterward.
Wow, so very thorough.
Very. They weren't just relying on vague trip reports from people on Reddit. They were looking for statistical correlations between concrete environmental variables and the acute experience of the drug.
So what did they find? Because the article implies it completely validated Leary's early 1960s observations.
It validated them entirely. They found that specific, tangible elements in the room, things like the presence of music, the presence of supportive people, and the absence of visual distractions, directly predicted the shape of the trip.
Just by tweaking the room.
Yes. A supportive environment with low distractions actively tilted the sessions toward emotional breakthroughs and what the researchers call mystical-type peaks.
Okay, we should definitely define that, too. For you listening, a mystical-type peak isn't just, you know, seeing cool colors on the wall.
No, not at all.
In clinical terms, it's a profoundly meaningful experience characterized by a sense of boundless unity, a loss of the rigid ego, and this deep, deep sense of awe. And the article notes that hitting that specific peak is actually one of the strongest predictors of long-term medical success.
That's the holy grail of the therapy.
Right. If you hit that peak, your depression or anxiety scores drop significantly months later.
And that's the vital medical takeaway here. The setting isn't just about making the person feel pampered or, you know, comfortable like at a spa. The setting is a clinical tool used to increase the probability of a medically successful outcome. Engineering the room engineers the medicine.
I want to zoom in on one of those setting variables you just mentioned, because the OOTW journal dedicates quite a bit of space to it, and it absolutely blew my mind.
Music, right.
Yes, music. Under the influence of LSD or psilocybin, the brain's emotional response to music isn't just enhanced, it's like fundamentally transformed. They say in psychedelic therapy, the curated playlist isn't just playing in the background to cover up street noise.
No, it's highly intentional.
They call it a second therapist that actively steers the emotional arc of the entire session.
Right, and remember the biology we discussed. Because the meaning-making association cortex is in overdrive, sensory boundaries begin to blur. It's a phenomenon very similar to synesthesia.
Oh, where you can, like, see sounds or taste colors?
Exactly. You don't just passively listen to a sad song through your ears. You inhabit the sadness as a physical dimension.
So the music isn't just background noise you're hearing. It literally becomes the architecture of the room you're walking through in your mind.
That is a phenomenal analogy. The music provides a structural framework, a sonic architecture, for the mind to navigate when the usual boundaries of the ego start to dissolve.
Wow.
Because without that architecture, without that guidepost, the mind can easily get lost.
Which perfectly bridges into the dark side of this extreme sensitivity. If a good setting builds a safe architecture, a bad setting does the exact opposite.
It really does.
The article explores this through the concept of thin containers. When researchers survey people who have had incredibly difficult, frightening trips, what pop culture calls a bad trip, they find a very clear cluster of conditions. These terrifying experiences almost always happen when high doses are taken in thin containers.
And just to clarify, a thin container means the environment simply cannot hold the psychological weight of the experience.
It's too fragile.
Right. It means taking the compound with no emotional support in an unsafe or unpredictable setting surrounded by distractions with absolutely no one there to guide you if panic sets in.
Which sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It is. When the glass gets hot and malleable, like in our earlier analogy, a thin container provides no mold. So the experience just shatters. This raises an important question, though. If we have the data and we know exactly what variables cause a terrifying experience, how do modern researchers engineer an environment to guarantee it doesn't happen?
Well, this is exactly why the modern clinical room for psychedelic trials looks the way it does. It is specifically scientifically designed to be the ultimate thick container.
Yes.
Right. If you look at a photo of a modern psilocybin trial at Johns Hopkins or Imperial College, none of it looks like a traditional hospital. You don't see linoleum floors or harsh fluorescent lights or sterile white beds and beeping monitors.
No, it looks like a living room.
Exactly. It's engineered on purpose to look like a cozy, warmly lit, mid-century modern living room.
Because every single element in that room is a deliberate clinical move to manipulate the setting.
Hmm.
I mean, before the dose is even administered, there are hours of preparation with therapists to build trust.
So they're fixing the set before they even touch the setting.
Precisely. That is explicitly managing the internal set we talked about earlier. Then, when dosing day finally arrives, the participant reclines on a comfortable couch, and they are immediately given eye shades to wear.
Let's explain the mechanics of the eye shades, because I thought this was fascinating. That isn't just to help them sleep, right? By taking away all visual stimuli in the room, you are forcing the brain's amplified 5-HT2A network to turn its meaning-making power entirely inward.
Precisely. It eliminates visual unpredictability.
Right. You can't get distracted.
Exactly. You can't get distracted by a weird shadow on the wall if your eyes are completely covered. Then they put on high-quality headphones, playing that carefully sequenced playlist we just discussed, providing the emotional architecture.
The sonic building, yeah.
And crucially, there are two trained guides sitting in the room with them the entire time.
The article points out a really beautiful detail about those guides, actually. The protocol dictates that they say little, hold much.
I love that phrase.
Me too. They aren't in there interrogating you or analyzing your childhood or doing traditional cognitive behavioral talk therapy. They are just providing a deeply trustworthy, grounding presence. If you reach your hand out in fear, someone is there to hold it.
Because the psychological goal is to prime your expectation so that whatever arises from the deepest, darkest parts of your subconscious can be met safely. The guides act as human anchors.
Wow, that's powerful.
And then finally, there is the integration phase in the days following this session. That's for helping the patient metabolize the profound experience into their everyday life.
Making sense of it all.
Right. So none of this, the couch, the eye shades, the playlist, the silent guides, none of it is mere decoration. The science tells us it's not optional. If you subtract the living room, take away the music, remove the guides, and administer that exact same identical molecule in a chaotic hospital ward, you will get a radically different, highly distressing biological outcome.
But you know, the room doesn't exist in a vacuum, does it?
No, it doesn't.
The individual's mind is inside the room, but the room is inside a society. And the researcher, Ido Hartogson, pushes this framework one level higher to the widest possible lens. He introduces the concept of the collective set and setting.
This is where the source material moves from the psychology of the individual to the sociology of the substance. Collective set and setting refers to the overarching cultural story, like the dominant narrative that a society tells about these molecules.
Because we carry our culture into the room with us, right? Yeah. Does the culture you live in view these substances as sacred sacraments? Are they respected clinical medicines? Are they tools for self-discovery?
Or are they seen as poison?
Exactly. Or, as has been the case for decades, fueled by, you know, 1970s anti-drug propaganda, are they viewed as dangerous threats? Illegal narcotics that will fry your brain. Hartogsen argues that this shared cultural frame seeps into every single private session, regardless of how beautifully decorated your clinical living room is.
It permeates everything.
Right. A culture of fear manufactures difficult trips, while a culture of reverence and safety manufactures want meaning.
It's a beautifully nested concept. You have the mind of the individual, which is inside the physical room, which is inside the broader cultural narrative. Mind, room, culture.
Matryoshka dolls of meaning.
Yes. And they are all interacting, communicating, and shaping the drug's effect simultaneously.
So what does this all mean for us? Let's ground this in a real-world scenario. Let's say I'm scheduled for a clinical trial today. I'm in the perfect mindset. The living room setting is ideal. The guides are there.
Okay, perfect setup.
But over breakfast, I read a terrifying news article about a bad trip. Or I watch a movie that portrays psychedelics as a dangerous threat. Does that cultural framing literally change the chemical reaction in my brain that afternoon, even if I'm in the perfect clinical setting?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the answer is undeniably yes.
That is wild.
It is, but think about it. That news article alters your baseline expectation. It introduces a subtle, perhaps even subconscious, thread of dread into your internal set. Right. And as we established earlier with the hot glass analogy, psychedelics act as active super placebos that amplify expectation.
So it's amplifying the news article.
Exactly. That cultural narrative you consumed over breakfast is carried into the setting with you. It becomes part of the raw material that the 5-HT2A receptors will amplify. The cultural frame literally shapes the biological event.
That is just mind-blowing to think about. You are not just metabolizing a chemical, you are metabolizing your culture's attitude toward that chemical.
Yes, beautifully said.
Which perfectly crystallizes the ultimate practical upshot from everything the OOTW Journal has laid out here. The biggest takeaway for you listening is this. You simply cannot separate a drug from the world you take it in. They are inextricably linked.
You can't divorce the two.
Yay. Building the world with care, you know, doing the psychological preparation, securing a safe physical space, curating the sound architecture, having trusted human support, and planning the integration that is a large part of the chemical event.
It's not optional.
Exactly. These things aren't just soft, holistic additions to the medicine. They are half of the medicine. The molecule merely opens the door, but the set and setting decide which room it opens onto.
And that profound reality leads to an implication that goes far, far beyond the realm of psychedelics and clinical trials.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Right. Let's think about your everyday, normal waking brain. Your sober brain relies heavily on serotonin to function. Those exact same 5-HT2A receptors we've been talking about, the ones densely packed in your association cortex, the ones responsible for weaving meaning out of raw data, they are always there.
They don't just appear when you take a drug.
Exactly. They are always active. They are quietly making meaning out of your context every single second of your life. Right now, as you listen to this,
they are constantly modeling our everyday reality based on our internal state and our external environment.
Exactly. So if psychedelics just turn up the volume on a meaning-making system that is already running, it begs an incredible question. How much of our everyday waking reality is just a product of our daily set and setting?
Oh, wow.
Think about the environment you consciously and subconsciously build for yourself. If we change our daily inputs, if we alter our cultural media diet to remove fear, if we change the aesthetic and safety of our physical spaces, and if we intentionally shift our internal expectations,
then what happens?
Well, can we fundamentally alter our baseline experience of reality entirely without the medicine?
Wow. If a chaotic, thin container can manufacture a bad trip on a chemical, maybe a chaotic, digital diet and a stressful environment, is manufacturing a bad trip in our everyday lives?
That's the question.
That is a lot to chew on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the non-drug half of psychedelic medicine. I really hope you take that final thought with you today. Think about the spaces you inhabit, the mindset you carry, and the narratives you consume.
Because you're always building your world.
Exactly. Because whether you realize it or not, you are always the architect of your own context. Just like those 10 people sitting in the room, the molecule of life might be exactly the same, but the world you build around it changes absolutely everything. We'll leave you to mull that over until next time.